Hebrews chapter 1. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty in heaven. So he became as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is superior to theirs. For to which of the angels did God ever say, "You are my Son, today I have become your Father"? Now there is one important little key to understanding the letter to the Hebrews, which has only occurred to me very, very recently. The various sections of Hebrews, as some of you will know, that are rather difficult to understand. There are others that are easy to understand, they're just more difficult to live up to. But there are one or two that are a little bit difficult to understand. But the thing that, it is so obvious, I really shouldn't insult your intelligence by saying it, but it's written to the Hebrews. And in that, it is different from every other letter in the New Testament. Every other letter in the New Testament is written either to a church, or to an individual, or to various groups of Christians. But if it's to a church, then it's to Christians. And if it was to an individual, all the individuals that received letters in the New Testament were Christians. And the scattered Christians that Peter writes to, for instance, are all Christians. But the Hebrews were not all Christians. And it's the only letter that is not specifically written to Christians. Some of the Hebrews were Christians. They are, of course, the national or the ethnic Jews. It's not only a matter of nationality, it's also a matter of original religion. Some of them were very definitely Christians. Some of them were very definitely not Christians. And some of them, quite honestly, didn't know whether they were or whether they weren't. They weren't sure. Why were some of them so definitely not Christians? Well, it was because to them, Christianity sounded like blasphemy. You see, the Jew has a huge problem in believing that Jesus is divine. The Jews recite every day, the Orthodox Jew, a prayer called the Shema, which starts with these words, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one." And the Jews are what's known as monotheists. They believe very definitely in one God. Of course, we do as well. And the Muslims do as well. And there is one God. And so they will say, if there is one God and he's in heaven, how could Jesus be God when he was on earth? And to say to them that Jesus is the Son of God sounds also like blasphemy, because they will turn around to you and say, God is not married, how can he have a son? The whole idea is disgusting to us. We reject it. And so there was a fairly strong body of Jews, we'll call them the right wing. And the right wing Jews are very, very traditional, very conservative, and for them the Christian message was absolute blasphemy. And if you try to communicate to a Jew today or to a Muslim telling them that Jesus Christ is God, it is very hard for them to accept that, and they will probably react violently. Now, on the other hand, of course, a great many Jews did become Christians. 3,000 of them on the day of Pentecost. All the first Christians were also Jews. Their place of worship was the synagogue, unless they lived in Jerusalem, in which case it was the temple. And there were a lot of factors of which they were enormously proud. It was partly national pride. It was partly religious loyalty. There was a temple, it was a magnificent temple, built on the site of the Temple of Solomon, built by Herod. A superb building. There was a priesthood with 1,500 years of tradition. And, quite recently, the United States celebrated their bicentennial. 200 years. And Canada is, you have a national day in July, don't you? You sing, "Oh, Canada." And you're a little bit proud of your country and your tradition, and there's move to to establish some of the important dates in your history and set up museums of Canadian memorabilia, etc. Why not? Nothing wrong with that. But if you have a couple of hundred years or so of tradition, think what 1,500 years was like for the Jew. It was important to them. It was woven into their whole character. And it was God-given. God gave them the Ten Commandments. Actually handed over to them. Their nation was founded on those. God had raised up man after man in their history, the prophets of Israel. They were all Jews. King David, King Solomon, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, all the other guys. Abraham, all Jews. And the idea of leaving all that to go after what? A criminal who'd been executed in shame outside the city? Somebody who was quite literally an outcast of society and condemned by both Jewish law and Roman law. And had become an object of shame and spitting on a hill just across the city. Not one building, not even a little mud hut with a grass roof for a church building. Why leave this magnificent temple for that? 15 years of priesthood going right back to Aaron, who was appointed by God himself. Why abandon all that? All those sacrifices they had, the marvelous ritual, the choir and everything else. Why leave all that for what? And it hurt their national loyalty, and it hurt their religious loyalty, and it didn't make a lot of sense according to the way they held on to the traditions of Scripture. So the right-wing bunch definitely rejected the gospel. The Christians, some of them were very firm, some of them asking a few questions. A fair body in the middle who had never really made up their minds where they were. Originally, they had tended to be attracted to the gospel. They had been impressed by the message, they'd been impressed by the quality of the life of the first believers. But now, 30, 35 years have gone by. Nothing has happened. Some things they expected to happen. One, they expected Jesus Christ to return physically. He hadn't done it. Two, they expected the nation of Israel to be converted to a man. It hadn't happened, and it obviously wasn't going to happen in their lifetime. Three, nearly all their leaders had died. Probably the only apostle left alive by this time was John. And they were beginning to have serious doubts, some of the believers. And some of those who had originally lent an ear to the gospel, been attracted by it, were beginning to think it isn't true after all. And they were beginning to drift back to the right-wing bunch and go back to the temple and to the sacrifices of the temple. And the letter is simply written to the Hebrews, all of them. Whether they were Christians, whether they were anti-Christians, or whether they were sympathizers. And understood in those terms, the letter to me has become a very beautiful whole and become powerful and meaningful. Just to sort of think ourselves into it a little bit, there is a tendency for us towards materialism. In that we are sometimes persuaded by the material. And we like rather to walk by sight in preference to faith. We're rather uncomfortable with the idea of having to live by faith, if we're very honest, because we like to be able to see things. It would be nice to be able to see where all the money is going to come from, for instance, for the Fairhaven's program, etc. If you're praying for somebody to be healed, it would be nice to be able to see that they were getting better. If God is calling you to go somewhere, it would be nice to be able to see everything coming together. It's reassuring. And when we can't see anything that's reassuring, we begin to doubt. And we're not all that different from the way they were. And we meet people on the outside and they say, prove that your God is real. I want to see it. And sometimes the achievements of men seem so prominent. In your own country, for instance, not very far from here, you've got the CN Tower. And the Space Center. The Science Center, rather. Places like Ontario Place, City Hall, all these sort of things, the mechanics of government. And a huge bank building. And they all look very, very solid and very powerful. The Air Force, the nuclear weapons, those things are real. And sometimes Christian resources look to be very meager and very sort of ethereal, almost unreal, compared to the concrete and the steel and the nuclear submarines. Hebrews is a letter for people who are a little bit troubled by those sort of things. One of the interesting things is that Jesus is not mentioned by name for quite a little while as the writer to the Hebrews writes. And he is a Hebrew writing to Hebrews. He's also a Christian. I'm pretty sure he's a Christian. But he is also a Hebrew writing to Hebrews. So he starts off, look, chapter 1, verse 1, in the past God spoke to our forefathers. And the very first thing he has done is to identify himself with the people he's wanting to communicate to. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers. I am really one of you, he's saying. And let me recommend that as an approach. I know the church has to be different. And I know if we're not clearly different, we don't have a message. And I don't happen to agree with people who want to ape the world as closely as possible in order to communicate with the world. Because once you begin aping the world, you sap your own vitality and you lose the distinctiveness of your Christian walk. And you don't have anything worthwhile left to say. But while I don't happen to agree with aping the world, neither do I agree with making yourself unnecessarily weird and creating unnecessary gaps between ourselves and the people we're trying to reach. I don't think it's particularly helpful to them, for instance. You may disagree, and you're quite at liberty to disagree. You can be as disagreeable as you like. But I don't think it's particularly helpful to the people we want to communicate to speak to them in early 17th century English. We might find it a help for our own personal devotions, scripture memory and things like that. But it doesn't help the people we're trying to reach if we speak a language which hasn't really been spoken in the streets for 200 years. And to use words that are kind of familiar, and yet even we don't really understand them, and illustrations that are definitely weird for people who don't understand what the illustrations mean. Like the blood of the Lamb. You and I know what it means. It's something very precious to us. It's just kind of grotesque to someone who doesn't know what it means. I don't want to be irreverent, but we've got a communications gap. And if you really want to reach someone for Christ, you have to somehow be able to find common ground and get alongside them. And I've been very impressed by one certain young person who's a great soul winner. And he had a friend who played chess. He himself didn't play chess, so he learned to play chess. And he read quite a number of books on playing chess. And he began to play against a computer until he could play just about as well as his friend. And he took him on at chess. And he cultivated that relationship for about 2 years before he shared the gospel with him. But after a couple of years, he was able to share the gospel because his friend asked him. And 6 months later, and his friend was a Christian. Then he had another friend who was a jogger. And this youngster hated jogging almost as much as I hate it. But he went jogging morning after morning till he could go with his friend 6 miles every day. His friend became a Christian. It's taken him 5 years to win 2 people. But his track record is better than most, isn't it? And I shouldn't make a big point of this because it's not really a major point in the letter. But you see what he's doing? He's establishing common ground. He said, look, I'm one of you. God spoke to our forefathers. I share with you in our national heritage. And I share with you the pride in our ancestry. And it is true. We believe this together. God spoke to our forefathers. Incidentally, one of the real reasons why I am absolutely convinced of the truth of the gospel is that when it came, it wasn't new. People thought it was new, but it wasn't new. Just for a moment, stick your finger in Hebrews and turn back to Luke chapter 24. Luke 24, verse 13. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. But they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, what are you discussing together as you walk along? They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, are you the only one living in Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that have happened there in these days? What things? He asked. About Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. What's more, it's the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. He said to them, "How foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken." Not slow because they did believe, but slow because they did not believe. How foolish you are and slow of heart in getting round to believing all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, Moses, of course, being the first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis to Deuteronomy, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. And that word explain is literally our word expound. It is to take the meaning that is already in there and bring it out. It is not to distort it and put on it a new interpretation. It is just to reveal the essential meaning that is contained within it. Then verse 30, when he was at table with them, he took bread and gave thanks, broke it and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened to us the scriptures?" Now notice what he did. These were two disciples. They knew Jesus. They knew what he had done. They had seen his life. They had heard his teachings. They had seen his miracles. They had probably seen him die. They were Jews and they knew the scriptures, and they knew them from Genesis to Malachi. And all he did was take the scriptures that they already knew, open the scriptures that they already knew, and show them that the scriptures that they already knew said the same thing as the Jesus that they already knew. And they got two bunches of information, both said exactly the same thing, but they had never put them together. And when they began to see them together, they said, "Didn't our hearts burn within us?" Because for 1,500 years, God had spelt out through Moses and through all the prophets the things concerning Jesus. Because the Old Testament is a book about Jesus. Every page of it. And the whole thing comes alive and makes sense when we interpret it in terms of Jesus. Otherwise, it's just a string of completely unrelated books with a bit of a thread of history going through. Turn to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17, verse 1. When they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a Jewish synagogue. Notice this. As his custom was, Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. "This Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Christ," he said. So what was Paul's standard technique? One, he went to the synagogue to look for the Jews. Two, he took the scriptures. Three, over a prolonged period, three Sabbath days, he reasoned with them. He didn't make an emotional appeal. He didn't say he's going to be happy all the rest of your life if you will just accept this free gift that's right here. He reasoned with them, explained to them, and proved to them that the Christ of their 1,500 years worth of prophecy was called Jesus. He had to leave there. The Jews got upset. And he went on to Berea. Verse 10 of Acts 17. As soon as it was night, the brothers sent Paul and Silas away to Berea. On arriving there, they went to the Jewish synagogue. Now the Bereans were of more noble character than the Thessalonians, for they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. Therefore, many of the Jews believed. Not because they were simple, not because they were gullible, but because they were prepared to check out in their scriptures and examine it, and prepared to let God show them whether it was true or whether it was not. And because they were of that mind and searched the scriptures, they were convinced. And they believed not because they were gullible, but because Jesus is the one who was foretold year after year after year after year by prophet after prophet for 1,500 years. And when Jesus came, the message was not new, it was already 1,500 years old. Acts chapter 18, verse 24. Meanwhile, a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was a learned man with a thorough knowledge of scriptures. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord and spoke with great fervor and taught about Jesus accurately, though he knew only the baptism of John. He wasn't even a Christian. He was a Jew. But he taught about Jesus accurately. John the Baptist was the last of the Old Testament prophets. John the Baptist was not a Christian. He was the last of the Old Testament prophets. How could he be a Christian if he died before Calvary? And here's one of his disciples, Epaphras, with a thorough knowledge of the scriptures, who could teach about Jesus accurately, and he never heard the gospel. Never met one of the apostles. He knew only the baptism of John. Verse 26, he began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they invited him to their home and explained to him the way of God more fully. Verse 27, when Apollos wanted to go to Achaia, the brothers encouraged him and wrote to the disciples there to welcome him. On arriving, he was a great help to those who by grace had believed, for he vigorously refuted the Jews in public debate, proving from the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. See, the statement that Jesus is the Messiah, that Jesus is the Christ, that Jesus is the Son of God, isn't new, and it wasn't new 2,000 years ago. It was already 1,500 years old 2,000 years ago. God had been telling them through all the pages of prophecy. And the standard technique of gospel preaching in New Testament days was to go first to the Jew and take the scriptures that the Jews knew and prove from the scriptures that Jesus was the Son of God. And so the writer to the Hebrews says, hey, I can agree with you guys. I really can. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets. I believe it. I have absolutely no doubt about it, he said. I'm one with you in this, and I don't want to belittle your reverence for your scriptures. God really did speak to our forefathers through the prophets in the past, at many times, and in various ways. It's interesting to see how many ways God did speak in the Old Testament. And the techniques the prophets used to communicate his message. Like Jeremiah building a clay model of Jerusalem and setting it up in the marketplace and having everyone come and look at it. Then turning his back on it and lying down day after day after day. A vivid picture of God turning his back on his people, ignoring them as the enemy came and destroyed the city. Not a popular message, but a faithful one, and a pretty vivid one. And even though they hated him for it, put him in prison and stuck him down a well, and if tradition is right, killed him in the end. They kept his writings, because they knew they were true. God spoke to us for lots and lots of little pieces of revelation. He said something through Abraham, something through David, something through Solomon, something through Jeremiah. Lots and lots of pieces of revelation, and God himself was speaking many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. God has not stopped speaking, he said. He has spoken to us by his Son. And it didn't stop with Malachi, and it didn't stop with John the Baptist. It stopped with Jesus. And if you, he says, really regard the Word of God as being important, and you reverence your Scriptures, you will even more reverence what God has said to you through his Son. And if you think it's a serious thing, my Jewish friend, to throw away the Old Testament, it's a serious thing to throw away the Word of God and Jesus Christ. In these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom he made the universe. Come back to that, because the writer comes back to it in the same chapter, and we've not time to look at it this morning. Verse 3, the Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. He is the outraying, the projection of God's glory. God's glory is not some kind of weird light that shines in heaven. God's glory isn't a reputation that we give him that he doesn't really deserve. God's glory is, in simple essence, his character. He is in himself glorious. That's why we glorify him, or ascribe glory to him, or recognize that he is glorious and talk about the glory of what he is. And Jesus is the transmission, the projection of the glory of God, the character of God. And in the past, God gave us lots and lots of little bits of revelation through the prophets, like individual pieces of a jigsaw. But in these last days, he's put the whole thing together and presented us with the entire picture in the person of his Son. And if you think the little piece that Moses gave us was important, and the little piece that David gave us was important, how much more important is the whole thing put together in Jesus? He is a projection of the glory of God. If you like, rather in the way that your TV screen gives you a projection of the action taking place in the studio. And the real thing is in the studio, but somehow it's in your living room as well. And the God of glory sits enthroned above heaven, and heaven and the heavens of heavens can't contain him, much less the temple that Solomon built. And yet he was contained in the body of an infant in Bethlehem. He is the projection, the outraying of God's glory, and the exact representation of his being. Let me ask you a question before you go to sleep. Do you know the truth? Do you know the truth? The truth about what? The truth about you. Do you know the truth about you? See, we know the truth about lots of things, like, for instance, a refrigerator. What's the truth about a refrigerator? A refrigerator is designed to keep food cold and stop it going rotten, isn't it? What's the truth about a car? A car is designed to carry human beings from one place to another place. Isn't that right? What's the truth about a washing machine? It's designed to wash clothes, get them clean, a little less fragrant. Isn't that right? Well, if you know the truth about a refrigerator, about a car, and about a washing machine, what is the truth about you? Why are you here? See, it takes a little bit more intelligence to design and produce a human being than it does a car, doesn't it? My car, anyway. So presumably there's a very intelligent, specific reason why you have been designed. You know what it is? It helps to know what it is, because if you know what it is, then you understand why you're here, and then you can get around to living for the reason that you are here. And the truth about you is just this. You were designed to tell the truth about your God. That's why you exist. You don't exist just to fill your stomach three times a day. And you don't exist just to come and occupy a seat in a conference hall twice a day. And you don't exist in order to be a parent or a church member or a pastor. You exist in order that you might tell the truth about God. And not just in words, on all. That you might tell the truth of God in your entire lifestyle. That your complete life would be one constant, accurate representation of the glory of your Creator. That you would tell the truth about Him. So that if somebody else wanted to know what God is like, all they would have to do is watch you. And as they watched you, they would see in your lifestyle a complete and accurate and unmisleading picture of God. They would see the truth of God in the way you live and in the way you talk. They would experience the wisdom of God just coming into contact with you. They would recognize the dazzling purity of God in your thought life, and in your speech, and in your human relationships. They will get a really true and unclouded picture of the love of God in the way you behave 24 hours every day. That's what the Bible means when it says, God created man in His own image. It doesn't mean he had a face like God. It means he had a lifestyle like God. A lifestyle that told the truth about God. Now I want you to suppose that way out yonder, in the black depths of outer space, there is a tiny planet called Phaetron. I'll spell it for you. Phaetron. And in this little tiny planet called Phaetron, there are some highly intelligent little green beings called Phaetrons. And they know that somewhere there is a God, but they only have one specific clue as to what he's like, or how you'd even find out. And their clue is this: there is a huge rock, about as big as Gibraltar, on planet Phaetron. And one surface is absolutely smooth, except that there are some words carved into it. And they've always been there. And these words are like this: God made man on planet Earth to tell the truth about himself. And for generations, the Phaetrons have discussed this. And they have said to themselves, you know, somewhere out there, amongst all those billions of stars, there is one with a little planet. And it's called Earth, and on it there's a creature called man, And man is an absolutely fantastic creature because he tells the truth about God. But at long last, they've got their technology to the point where they can build a spaceship, and they've done it. And there's a spaceship sitting out on a launch pad on planet Phaetron. And every last little Phaetron is in front of his TV set. The ones on the light side of the planet have come home from work, and the ones on the dark side have got up out of bed, and every last one has got his little green nose pressed up against his TV screen. And the three selected Phaetronauts are standing beside their spaceship as the president of the planet has his final interview with them, and the TV camera zooms in on them. And he's saying to them, now you're going to go to planet Earth. And you're going to spend 3 Earth months down there, and you're going to find out everything you can possibly find out about this marvelous creature called man. And then you come back, and you tell us what man is like, and once we know what man is like, then we'll know what God is like. Wishes them a good journey, shakes paws with the three of them, and the three of them get into their spaceship, and the door closes, he goes into his dugout, and the whole planet joins in the countdown, 10, 9, 8, until blastoff comes right to the split second. And the spaceship surges up into their atmosphere, and they all watch as it rushes forward higher and higher, becomes a little dwindling speck and disappears. Then they go back to work, or they go back to bed, and the spaceship lands in Brazil. And they hide it in the jungle, and they come out and they make themselves invisible, green and invisible. And they go all over Brazil recording their observations of all the people they can see. And then they board a 747 and they fly over to Portugal. Nobody sees them because they're invisible, but they watch on the aircraft, and they watch the stewardesses, and they listen to the pilot's conversation, and they listen to the passengers, and they watch them eat their meals and sleep the way passengers do with their shoes off and everything. And then they land in Portugal, have a look there, and then they go across to England, which is almost the highlight of their trip. I should say perhaps not England, but Great Britain. And they have a look around there, and then they go across to Paris. And then they keep heading east, and they have a look at Berlin, and Moscow, and Tokyo. And then they come around, they land in Vancouver. They have a look at that, then they come across, land again in Toronto. And they come to Fairhaven. Do you believe that? Phaetrons are their contract. They haven't paid either. And they go into your trailer or your camper or your tent or your dormitory. They're in the dining room. They're in the meeting hall. They ride home with you in your car. They go to your church, go to your home. You don't see them, but they don't miss a thing. They go on to New York, down to Mexico City, Panama, back to Brazil. They take off and they go back to Phaetron. And the day comes when they're expected back. There's been no messages in between. Radio communication's not been possible. But as the time comes for them to land again, all the planet is in a fever of anticipation. All the TV sets are turned on, and they watch with bated breath. Sure enough, the little spot appears. It'd be absolutely terrible if it got wrecked.